Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 5 days now of devastation and defiance in Gaza. Israel rejecting a 48-hour ceasefire, death tolls climbing, rockets out of Gaza flying deeper into Israel, and Israeli ground forces massing perhaps for an invasion. This hour, On Point, we're looking at Israel, Hamas, and Gaza in flames. There was talk of a ceasefire. Israel apparently rejecting that, a 48-hour ceasefire. Here's the Israeli Defense Minister, Ehud Barak, telling reporters yesterday in Ashkelon that the military campaign in Gaza would continue for as long as necessary.
We will do whatever it takes. We are ready to deepen and widen the operation in order to make sure that calm and tranquility will come back to the region.
Ready to deepen and widen the operation. And here's Mustafa Barghouti, Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative, this morning on NPR's Morning Edition, calling Gaza a population under siege and blaming Israel for civilian casualties.
These are not attacks on military targets. Of course there will be so many casualties. What I'm trying to say here is that people cannot lose their humanity and accept this bloodbath.
Joining me first today from Jerusalem is Margaret Coker, Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Margaret, thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome.
First of all, you've been reporting from all around Gaza, but have you yet been able to get into Gaza?
No, there are restrictions on foreign journalists and where we're allowed to report during this conflict. Israel controls all of the land borders into Gaza, and they have closed those borders to us.
The Supreme Court there ruling that the next time those borders are open, some foreign reporters will be allowed in. Is that correct?
Well, we're working out some sort of deal with the Israelis right now. The Foreign Press Association here in Israel is trying to get permission for a pool of foreign journalists to be allowed in when humanitarian aid is also allowed into Gaza, although it's a very narrow window of time that we might be able to go inside.
So in some sense, you're seeing this secondhand, as many around the world are, though from a much closer vantage. How would you describe the scale of destruction inside Gaza first at this point, Margaret?
Well, most of us journalists rely on local fixers or local stringers within Gaza, Palestinians who live there and report out to us. So we do have really reliable firsthand witnesses and first reports of what's happening there. Inside Gaza, within all of the major cities, there's massive damage, massive destruction to a lot of infrastructure. And that infrastructure includes administrative buildings that government has used to run the territory. It also includes non-military targets like mosques and people's homes.
And the tunnels along the Gaza border with Egypt, how widespread is the destruction? How many tunnels apparently there? How much of that appears to have been closed down at this point?
Well, that is completely unverifiable, unfortunately. Israel says that it's hit at least 40 tunnels. Nobody actually knows how many tunnels there exist. Reliable estimates put the number up around 600. So that, if Israel's numbers are right, there's only a small percentage that have been closed down. These tunnels have been the major and only commercial lifeline that the 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza have had for going on about 18 months. There's been a full blockade of the territory, and to get anything from toilet paper to cooking oil to chickens sometimes, the tunnels are the only way that people have been able to survive. It is also the infrastructure that Hamas uses to bring in military equipment like rockets.
And let's just understand, because the blockade is important, exactly how is the blockade enforced? And this is enforced entirely by Israel or by Egypt as well? And for what purpose, Margaret? Why?
Right. Well, when Hamas took over the running of the Gaza Strip after it won Palestinian elections in early 2006, Israel and its backers within the international community, including the Bush administration, have worked on diplomatic ways or military ways to force the Hamas government out of power. And one of the strategies was to squeeze the Palestinian population within Gaza to be able to somehow make a popular uprising against the legitimately elected Hamas government there. So the blockade has been enforced through the Israeli side of the border. Israel won't allow in goods or cargo except in specific circumstances where humanitarian aid is let through. There's another border that does connect Gaza to Egypt, but that border has also been closed for many months. It's not a cargo border. That is, there can't be commercial goods going back and forth through it. It's also been used as a humanitarian access and a land border that Gazans can leave the Gaza Strip.
So very tight restrictions on what's been coming into Gaza for a long time now, only those tunnels uncontrolled. What about what's come out of Gaza, the rocket fire over time? How many, and has it continued full bore since the Israeli attacks on Gaza, or is it diminishing, the rocket fire out of Gaza?
Well, the rocket been coming out of Gaza for quite some time. This is the way that Hamas's major military threat to Israel at large. And over the course of the last 18 months, thousands of rockets have left Gaza. These are a mixture of homemade, almost pipe bombs that can be launched a couple of miles. And now they've become more sophisticated. Hamas is able to use, produce, and smuggle in old Soviet-style rockets that the Soviets called Katyushas and that are known in the region as Grad missiles. Those missiles have been able to penetrate Israel upwards of 20, 25 miles. So major Israeli cities are now under threat of these rockets.
We read of four Israelis. Sorry, Margaret.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Just we read of four Israelis, three civilians, and one military dying in the days since this current operation began, and 380 or so Palestinians, including the UN, says 60-plus civilian women and children. What is known about the death toll, and who's dying inside Gaza?
Right. Well, again, without a full body count from outside observers like us, we are relying on the UN and other credible humanitarian aid groups who have people on the ground in Gaza. So we have a mixture of members of Hamas, militant fighters who are affiliated with Hamas, and civilians. Gaza is one of the most overpopulated and tightly populated places in the world. So the location of targets is going to be next to places where people live, work, and go to school, and civilians do and always have gotten caught up in the crossfire in Gaza. So the casualties there have included children who have been outside. They've included civil defense forces who have been trying to move people to safe places. One of the issues for the Gaza population is that they have no bomb shelters. There's no place underground safe for them to be in. The only place they have are buildings. And if they get hit or damaged during what Israel calls their pinpoint strikes on military targets, there is no place else for them to be. Gazans cannot leave the Gaza Strip right now.
Margaret Coker with The Wall Street Journal joining us from Jerusalem. Margaret, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Joining me now from Washington is Aaron David Miller with the Woodrow Wilson International Center in Washington. He's been an advisor to six U.S. Secretaries of State on Arab-Israeli negotiations and is author of The Much-Too-Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. Aaron David Miller, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks. It's a pleasure, Tom.
Why is this happening?
It's happening because a very weak and vulnerable ceasefire no longer serves the interests of either party in this case. And in this case, we're talking about a confrontation between two entities, Israel and Hamas, which do not share much of a modus vivendi for not only an informal accommodation, but anything beyond that. And this will come to an end as wars often do, under only one of two circumstances. One side will impose its will on the other, which is simply out of the question, or both sides will feel that they either have or have not accomplished their objectives. And I suspect it will be the latter. So this dynamic on the ground, we're nowhere close to an end to this.
Nowhere close to an end. Does that mean we're reading here that targets easily accessible from the air are running out? Israel's hit a lot already. Does that? Do you expect a ground operation? Do you expect Israeli boots on the ground in Gaza before it's over?
I do, because again, back to what the objectives of each party are and can they achieve them. The Israelis would like an end to all the rocket fire as a sort of precondition to cease hostilities. They won't get it. Hamas, on the other hand, in the following the Hezbollah precedent from the July-August 2006 war, plans to emerge from this with a political victory. They want to be able to say that we, like our Hezbollah brothers, stood up to the most powerful military in the Middle East, the Israeli Defense Forces, and we survived not only massive and punitive airstrikes, but we survived an Israeli incursion. And I suspect before this is out, there will be some form of Israeli incursion, not a reoccupation of the Gaza Strip, but Israelis in Gaza looking for rockets and Hamas operatives.
Masked already on the border. Thanks to Aaron David Miller. Please stand by in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Sound there from a rally in Cairo on Monday. Thousands of demonstrators gathering to protest Israel's airstrikes in Gaza, as well as the Egyptian government's unwillingness to open its border to Palestinians fleeing the bombing. We're talking today about Israel and Hamas and what comes next. We've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Aaron David Miller, author of The Much Too Promised Land, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and advisor to six U.S. Secretaries of State on Arab-Israeli negotiations over the years. We're joined as well now from Tel Aviv, Israel by Shai Feldman, director of the Crown Center for Middle East Studies and professor of politics at Brandeis University. Shai Feldman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Pleasure.
And with us from Normal, Illinois, Issam Nasser, professor of history at Illinois State University, Palestinian living in the United States. Issam Nasser, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Shai Feldman, what do you make of what's happened so far, and why do you think Israel said no to a 48-hour humanitarian ceasefire?
Well, first of all, the proposal that's been considered until now has been a unilateral ceasefire. There are two kinds of debates that are going on kind of simultaneously. One is exactly regarding the issue of whether Israel should stop now unilaterally and essentially let Hamas have 48, 72 hours to decide whether it wants to essentially renew the truce that they decided not to extend on December 19. And then, of course, there is the option that if Hamas, even after the 72 hours, continues to launch rockets against Israeli population centers, then Israel, of course, can continue the fire. I personally must say that I favor that. But the idea of a unilateral ceasefire, precisely because of a point that Aaron Miller mentioned a few seconds ago, which is the issue of what kind of narrative would Hamas write regarding a unilateral Israeli move, which is, say, a declaration of Hamas victory, I guess was an issue for those who, for the moment, have rejected this. There's a second debate, which has to do with what are the minimal objectives. And Alan mentioned one of them. There is, of course, one of them being a complete cessation of these rocket attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, of course, a maximalist, which is outside the government, but the right-wing opposition, of course, is demanding a maximalist objective, which is a destruction of the Hamas entity in Gaza. I don't think anybody serious in the government or in the security realm is advocating that. But there is an intermediate realm objective, which is strengthened with every launching of these rockets deeper and deeper inside Israel, and that is to put an end to the arms buildup of Hamas, these rockets, the accumulation of longer and longer range rockets. And as I said, there's a debate whether to just be content with a ceasefire or to demand this further constraint on the arms buildup.
Issam Nasser, I want to hear you on this. Let's listen first to, this is Mark Regev, spokesman for Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, telling CNN yesterday that Israel was considering many options but did not want to rush into a ceasefire that he said would allow Hamas to gain strength.
We wouldn't want a situation that just allows Hamas a timeout to rearm, regroup, and prepare for the next round. We want to keep pressure on Hamas until we have clear understandings that the situation is going to be quiet.
That is Mark Regev, spokesman for Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert yesterday. Issam Nasser, can Israeli force bring a situation that, in his words, is going to be quiet?
Well, to some extent, yes, on the short run, that is. But on the long run, this is a political crisis. This is a political problem. Without a political solution that guarantees the freedom of the people of Gaza, that guarantees the continuity between the West Bank and Gaza, that opens the borders for goods and people to move in and out, the situation is going to continue one way or another. You cannot just imprison an entire population, besiege them for so many months, and expect them to sit quietly.
What are you hearing from friends, associates in Gaza? Are you in touch with people there? Is it possible?
Yes, it is. Ironically, the phones are still working, although not the cellular phones. I suspect the flying over and the bombing effect might have affected that. People in general are scared. I mean, people have no place to go. They don't know where it is to be safe. The stories I hear are horrifying. I mean, you know, we've seen some of them on the news, but to talk about the people I know, one person, for example, lost his leg in the bombing and was taken, this is someone I know, was taken to the hospital. And the next thing, the Israeli aircrafts bombed the mosque next to the hospital, and the entire window is chatter all over him and his face. So now he's, you know, it wasn't even safe in the hospital for this person, and he is in a much worse situation. Luckily, he managed to send him to Egypt at this point. So it is a situation of continuous fear. People are desperate. Bakeries are closed. Food is scarce. No electricity. And, you know, no safety whatsoever.
Shai Feldman, you're in Israel, in Tel Aviv. Israeli popular opinion is diverse. We know that. But how are you reading public opinion on these attacks now on their fifth day? How supportive or otherwise? And how does it break down?
Well, I think I would say two things. There's a very broad consensus that Israel had no choice once the Israeli understanding is that Hamas refused to extend the truce, the six-month truce that expired on December 19. There is also a consensus that Israel has the right to demand an end of all this rocket fire. Our colleague from the Wall Street Journal used the term Israeli centers or population centers under threat. They're not under threat. They're under attack now. And for example, today in Beersheba, the largest city in the south, no one has gone to elementary school, high school, university is closed, and so on, because the place is under rocket attack. So around this particular minimalist objective, there's a very broad consensus. There's also a broad consensus about the operation so far, which is to say Air Force use, no ground forces, and so on and so forth. What will happen now is because of these continuous and deeper attacks, if the weight of the second objective, which is to say we don't end this without a similar limitation on arms buildup on Hamas's side, and if particularly if Aaron is correct that this would require a ground operation, what would happen to the consensus then is, of course, unclear. We'll only see this if this second phase will in fact take place.
Aaron David Miller in Washington, it's pretty clear, and the whole world sees it on the television screen, that Israel can destroy more or less whatever it chooses to in Gaza. But can it destroy its way to a successful outcome here? Can it? Do you think it, for example, can divide the Palestinian population of Gaza from Hamas? Are they likely to say Hamas has just brought us more trouble than they're worth, and we can't stay with them? Or does this drive the Palestinians deeper into the arms of Hamas, Aaron?
You know, I think one of the political laws of gravity that has operated in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for some time now, and it was true even before Hamas took over in Gaza, is that Palestinians, as long as the occupation continues, and I think you'd have to distinguish in terms of the use of that word, occupation, for between Gaza and the West Bank, but as long as the occupation continues, or even closed airspace, closed access to the sea, closed borders, Palestinians will always, and I think it's almost without exception, be angrier at Israel, and by implication, Israel's supporters, including the United States, than they ever will be with respect to their own leadership.
But isn't there the point that there is not an occupation of Gaza now? There's an embargo, there's maybe a chokehold, there's certainly a bombardment, but the Israelis pulled out of Gaza.
I drew that distinction, but it doesn't change, in my judgment, whatever personal frustrations Gazans may feel, and there have to be many, and there has to be great ambivalence and great conflict, even with respect to Hamas. In the end, it will not generate the kind of political or public support to force a change in the leadership or a fundamental sea change in public opinion that somehow the masses will rise up and understand that it is Abbas, not Hamas, that offers a political pathway toward the realization of Palestinian political and national aspirations. I mean, there's great logic there. That's how the West views it. That's how the Bush administration views it. That's almost certainly how the incoming Obama administration will view it. But I do not. I think that's seeing the world the way we want it to be, rather than the way it is. And Americans are experts in seeing the world the way they want it to be, rather than the way it really is. And frankly, I suspect my friend Shai Feldman will agree with me, Israelis actually have gained a certain amount of expertise in that area as well.
I want to pursue that, but we have a lot of people who want to join us first. Let me take a couple of calls here. Shai Feldman, Issam Nasser, please stand by. David in Cranston, Rhode Island, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to ask a question that actually kind of ties in with something your guest just mentioned, that you know, we sit here frustrated wondering why we gave the Palestinians in Gaza an opportunity to have free elections. They elected Hamas, and I guess we feel, why are they not, you know, demanding from their leadership a different approach? And if that's not going to happen, my question is, what role can the Arab governments and the Arab nations in the region play in pressuring Hamas to drop what I think is the central problem here, which is their opposition to the existence of Israel? I mean, their charter calls for the destruction and the extermination of Israel and the Israeli Jews. And I don't think we can even have a conversation about ceasefires or anything with a country, you know, with another entity that is devoted to your destruction.
David, you're breaking up pretty badly on us, so I'm going to just take it right there. Of course, in some ways, you have to have a conversation with people who are sitting right on one another's doorstep. Issam Nasser, let me come first to you on that. You hear our caller, David, saying, you know, how do we ever have a conversation with Hamas devoted to the destruction of Israel? How do you see this getting out of rockets and bombs and to a conversation, Issam?
Well, the problem, Tom, the way I see it with the question and partly with the response, earlier response by Mr. Feldman, Tel Aviv, is the underlying assumption that the problem really is Hamas, and the problem is that Israel is under intense attack by this irrational force that is keen on its destruction, and so Israel has no choice. The reality on the ground is that you have people who, about 1.5 million or 1.3 million people, who actually live in a massive prison controlled by Israel. Their airspace, their borders, their gas, their food supplies, everything is dependent on Israel. And for the last 18 months, you could say, or more so, because they elected Hamas, and we need to remember that the elections was imposed practically on the Palestinian leadership because George Bush wanted to democratize the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So, and when the result was not in the way we like it, we decided, along with Israel and the European Community, to boycott that government. So that government is not really a government. It's just a number of elected people who have no control, no real control over their territories. They have no resources. The majority of the elected parliamentarians are in prison and have been for over a year now. The infrastructure is completely in shambles. And then we present the whole thing as the problem is that Hamas has these primitive rockets that so far had killed 4 people, but over the last few years probably had scared more people than it, than it injured them or anything like this. So there is a serious problem here in not seeing what the problem is. The problem is, as Mr. Miller earlier said, is the occupation. And yes, the occupation continues in Gaza, because Israelis might not be inside Gaza exactly, but they control it. Mm. What is occupation at the end of the day? It is
control. You say, Issam, stand by for a moment. Shai Feldman in Tel Aviv, you hear Issam Nasser's perspective here, and Aaron David Miller saying earlier, the only solution is a political solution. How do you get from the bombs falling now to a political solution, even if it's your sort of minimal objective plus half, even if somehow you can go in and get some rockets out, how do you get enough Palestinians, you know, optimistic about their future that they step away from the confrontational posture toward Israel?
Let me just take a first cut at this. Mm-hmm. In the interest of honesty and clarity, this notion of a political solution, that there is a possibility in the near term, let's say over the next year or two, for a conflict-ending solution between Israelis and Palestinians on Jerusalem borders, refugees, and security, the 4 core issues, the prospects of that happening are slim to none. And the sooner we understand the character and nature of this problem, the more honest and effective whatever policy responses Israelis, Palestinians, and Americans and Arabs devise to try to temper or ameliorate this conflict.
So an ultimate solution may be out of reach, but people are pretty skeptical about a real military solution. Do you really think there is one?
No, there is no military solution. At the end of the day, when all the killing is stopped and the grieving in Gaza and Israel end, the 3 basic realities that have impeded this process will remain. Number 1, the Palestinian national movement will remain broken and dysfunctional and in crisis. 2 polities, 2 armies, 2 ideologies, 2 negotiating positions. Number 2, Israel will remain divided and unsure, even to this day, about the price it is prepared to pay for a conflict-ending solution with the Palestinians. And 3, the issues themselves, particularly Jerusalem and refugees, will remain without resolution. At best, and it's not a happy outcome, you can manage or try to manage, as the Obama administration is soon to find out, the Israeli-Palestinian issue. But there is no peace treaty here. There is a deal farther north between Israel and Syria. There's absolutely no question about that. And I'm not suggesting you ignore the Israeli-Palestinian problem. You can't. But I'm also suggesting we not proceed on the assumption we can resolve it.
We certainly can't ignore it today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here's Israel's foreign ministry, Tzipi Livni, in Washington on Monday, telling reporters that Hamas is to blame for the civilian casualties on both sides of the conflict.
We are trying to target Hamas, which hides among civilians. They don't care. They are responsible to the situation in Gaza. Israel wants to live in peace in the region, but we cannot because Hamas is targeting our civilians from civil population centers in Gaza.
Let's go to the phones. We have many callers. Gafan from Hamden, Connecticut. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I am a Palestinian who lived here for 10 years, and I have a comment about when Israeli politicians are interviewed on TV, they ask the question, what will the U.S. do if Canada send them rockets? And my question is to the Israeli leaders is, I'm saying, if what will happen if U.S. is occupying Canada? Do you expect Canada not to send them to launch rockets at them? Another question I have is, really, I'm struck by how superficial is the American public opinion and the elite also understanding of the Palestinian plight. We did not occupy Israel. Israel is occupying us. We did not go and build a state somewhere in something called Israel. Israel came and built a state or created a state in our land.
Gafan, let me ask you then, do you see a solution here that includes the state of Israel?
Yeah, I see a solution. I see a solution when everybody has equal rights. Everybody is 100% have equal rights in this state, whatever you want to call it, Palestine, Israel, Palestine, and Israel.
You mean do you mean a two-state solution or a one-state solution that we're...
No. A two-state solution is a racist solution. So, I want a solution where we as Palestinians have equal rights, equal access to everything in Palestine.
Gafan, we hear it loud and clear. We've got it. It's very clear, and I thank you for it. I've got a lot of callers. Let me get one more here from Kamal in Providence, Rhode Island. Kamal, you're on the air.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what is the purpose of Hamas. And the Hamas is basically the purpose is to eliminate Israel, which is a state. A country that all the world is accepting as a state. So if Hamas does not accept that, then this whole thing is going to go and continue, no matter what.
Do you think the Israeli bombardment helps move Hamas away from that acceptance or not?
Well, it,
the rejection?
It's just like you having a cold, you take medication to eliminate the cause of the cold. So Israel has to do something in order to keep its existence. As far as all the Arab countries, they agree that Israel exists, but Hamas doesn't. So basically, those who do not accept Israel's existence will help Hamas to keep that purpose going on.
So there a critical view, Kamal, that you've got of Hamas, and we've got that. Let me get one more and turn to my guest, John, in Ames, Iowa. John, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking me. I think that last caller kind of falls into what I was thinking, was that we're way too willing as Americans to accept the, you know, the bombs falling, and we always present these ideas like, an idea as simple as like, all we need is peace over there, and we're going to write off, you know, anything that sounds like, well, we could have, you know, a solution that makes everybody happy. We just write that off as a naive thought. And we always say, like, well, the next administration is going to find out that they're not able to do it. I don't understand where it comes from the American psyche. We're so willing to just write off, you know, a good solution, as simple as peace over there. And when we listen to these naysayers, it's like, well, that's just naive. We need to just look the other way and not pay attention or let them figure it out.
So if the U.S. were going to be more involved, John, what do you think it should be doing?
Well, I think, and one thing we talked earlier about, you know, not having any channels in with the Hamas leadership. And so what interesting thing I heard was like, well, we're not bombing civilians, we're bombing Hamas. Yet Hamas is a democratically elected entity. So we're saying that, okay, they're a government chosen by the people, but we're not bombing the people, we're bombing their government. And I don't understand why Americans are so willing to allow that distinction to be made when there's really, it's the people that are being bombed over there, and we don't even want to talk to them.
Of course, I mean, and it is clear that as tightly packed as Gaza is, civilians are dying. And David Miller, this has come back around to U.S. policy here. You've worked a lot on that. You hear callers, John, there, critical of the U.S. kind of standing by and watching this and having a sort of defeatist attitude on the possibility of peace. How does this come back to Washington and American policy? How may it land on Obama's desk? With what kind of imperatives or decisions to be made, Aaron?
You know, it's an interesting question. Governing really is about choosing. This man, President-elect Barack Obama, is coming into office against the worst backdrop of an economic and financial crisis in this country since the Great Depression. He's going to have to set his priorities, and clearly they are not going to be foreign policy priorities in the main. Yet at the same time, in order to be a consequential president, he cannot escape being a foreign policy president. But mm-hmm. he's going to inherit what I would argue to you is an investment trap. He cannot run away from the Israeli-Palestinian problem, for sure. It is his crisis, and it will be the first crisis for his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. Mm. But he also cannot resolve it. So as a consequence, he's going to have to come up with, and it's not an ideal position, an approach to try to manage and defuse it. There really is no other alternative. You know, we sometimes miss the point. There is no precedent in modern history for a great power interceding and intervening and resolving a conflict driven by memory, history, identity, and trauma. We somehow think that we can manage history. The last 8 years, I would argue the last 16 years of American foreign policy, eight under Bill Clinton, eight under George W. Bush, has proved precisely the opposite point. We are not as powerful or all-powerful as we think.
And yet we've heard again and again, Aaron, that the Bush administration's less engaged posture here is in part to blame for the bad pass we're in once again.
I think there's...
Can I come in on this one?
Let me just get Aaron, and then I'll come right to you. But first, Aaron, quickly on that. I want to go to Shai.
I think there's an element of that. When Arafat dies in November of 2004, and Mahmoud Abbas is elected in fair and free elections in January, well before Hamas seized power, the Bush administration, instead of trying to move quickly to empower him and work with then-Prime Minister Sharon on a serious negotiating process, simply acceded, largely in this case, to its own priorities and to Sharon's wishes, and missed a huge opportunity, which conceivably could have preempted us from the situation we're in now.
Shai Feldman, those are American-made F-16s and Apache helicopters. So Americans know very vividly and viscerally that we have a stake in doing the right thing here.
Let me get into this. First of all, I think that before we, in the remaining 15 minutes of this program, resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict, we have an acute crisis at our hands, and the issue is right now, how do we deal with this crisis? And I think we sort of a little bit wandered off from this very acute question right now. I want to make two comments about this. Number one, I don't think that the Hamas entity is irrational. I think it's rational, and any attempt to affect its behavior has to assume its rationality. Number two is it's true that it's not a country. And it's true that in formal sense, it's not a government. But the fact of the matter is that when the Hamas entity in Gaza decided to abide by a truce over the previous 6 months, it actually was able to enforce that truce, not only on its own forces, but also on the forces of all sorts of more extreme groups that are operating in Gaza and so on and so forth. Now, as long as we understand that we are in an acute crisis, we have to ask ourselves, is it possible... Before we resolve the whole conflict, which we would all like to, is it possible to at least get to a point where we end this without further violence? And let me just suggest that there's a good precedent for that and, of course, complications. The good precedent is that with all the disadvantages and the problems, the Israeli conflict with Hezbollah in the summer of 2006 conflict ended in a situation where as of that end of that conflict in the summer of 2006, today until today, two years and 4 months, Not a single rocket was launched by Hezbollah against Israel, which means that it is possible, precisely because we're dealing with extremist but rational actors, it's possible to form a balance of deterrence with them that would prevent them, that would make them decide not to continue the violence. Now, the problem that we have right now with the U.S. and other factors is in trying to do this is that we don't have really an American partner. We have one administration that's packing its boxes and another administration that will only come in on January 20, which is more than 20 days from now, and we're facing an acute crisis. Number two, to engineer a ceasefire that includes limitations on arms buildup, this has to have a monitoring and verification system that involves third parties. It's very complicated to get these third parties on board and to agree to it. Meanwhile, the pressure to go in to a ground operation increases. And finally, I want to say that as Hamas wages its conflict with Israel, it simultaneously wages a conflict against the national secular forces, the Palestinian Authority, and Fatah. And the issue here is also here, how do we emerge from this conflict in a way that Hamas does not emerge so strong that the more moderate, more pragmatic, secular forces that are now leading the Palestinian Authority do not come out of this so weakened by Hamas's ability to write a narrative of victory. This is a very big problem because it really means that those secular nationalist forces that have become Israel's partner in a futile negotiation, but a negotiation nonetheless, will be damaged might get damaged seriously by the outcome of this conflict.
Issam Nasser, let me ask you about that. Do you believe Israel can achieve a balance of deterrence with Hamas in Gaza through this kind of action?
On the short run, I think so, and I agree with Mr. Feldman that the example of the war in 2006 with Lebanon is a good example.
But Hezbollah declared victory there and has, by all reports, built up its military strength very substantially since then.
That's true, partly, but there are particular Lebanese internal politics that we shouldn't get into at this point. Mm-hmm. Hamas, on the other hand, which is, I also agree, is a threat to Palestinian secular movement in general and national movement on one level, is gaining more popularity because it is alone standing up for an Israeli invasion. And if I may add to some of the issues that were raised earlier, no one seemed to remember that shortly we're going to head to elections in Israel. And the right, the extreme ultra-right wing of Likud and others is getting high rates in the polls.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, knowing the history of Israel, a country that has historically been ruled by generals more or less, I think that the current Israeli government cannot afford to have an ending to the war like the one in Lebanon. Because that will mean that they will never make it into the elections. So there is an election issue here that we should take into account seriously, I think.
I'll look at that in just a moment. Two quick calls. Julie in Providence. Quickly, if you can, Julie. We're near the end of our time.
Hello. I just wanted to respond to, there was a Palestinian-American who called in.
Yes.
And I wanted to pick up on his comment. He said that a two-state solution is, by definition, racist. And I think this indicates part of the larger problem. How are the Israelis supposed to deal with a people who considers their very nationhood, their right to sovereignty, a racist problem? And secondly, I'd like to comment on the apparent double standard with which it's very easy for the United States to American citizens, British citizens, French, to pontificate. What should the Israelis do? Can one even imagine if Canada, if outside the Canadian border or outside the Mexican border, we had Canadians launching rocket attacks into New York?
Julie, we've got that perspective, absolutely, and we've heard it. At the same time, there is a big American interest here. One last call, Sanjupta Castleton, Vermont. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to bring up something that has just been said, not by this caller, but by your panelists, about the secular nature of the Palestinian national movement. that if Hamas has taken on an Islamic tone, Israel is to blame. After all, the Palestinian movement was always secular and nationalist. But there's another point I wanted to make, and that is the control of groundwater resources.
Sanjipta, that's how we take your point on Hamas having an Islamic cast. It certainly does. Aaron David Miller, Israeli elections right in front of us here. Tzipi Livni and Ehud Barak, we heard from each of them this hour, and they're both in the thick of that. Is that steering the outcome or the direction of Israeli policy right now? Is it the ultimate?
Well, all foreign policy initiatives in Israel are partly related to domestic politics as a consequence of the peculiarity of the Israeli political system. I'm not sure that's the driving force. I think the outcome of this conflict will, in fact, have a decisive impact on the elections in February, assuming they're not postponed as a consequence of the current crisis. Just one last point. You know, the Israeli-Hezbollah war came to an end under very unsatisfactory terms, in large part because both sides wanted a ladder to climb down. The UN Security Council gave them that ladder.
Yep.
I'm not sure you're going to get as formal an undertaking this time around, but you will get a ladder. It will appear either in the form of an Egyptian, Turkish, maybe even American orchestrated initiative to calm this down. But under no circumstances will it provide a pathway out of this.
Maybe a ladder, a bloody one. Aaron David Miller in Washington at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Thank you for being with us. Shai Feldman of Brandeis University in Tel Aviv. And Issam Nasser, thank you all for joining us this hour. Too short. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.